We live in a world that is moving from order to disorder. And while God created orderliness and saw that everything was very good, man's sin had consequences that impacted even the natural world. Among those consequences was a natural inclination for physical things to degrade over time. And while in many contexts it is possible to resist and reduce this degradation, it is only done at the expense of great amounts of energy, and even then, it's temporary. There is a finite amount of usable energy in our universe. Therefore, overall, physical things run down despite all of the energy that we may put into them. And thus, maintaining order is a constant struggle. The tendency toward disorder is readily seen in every area of our physical lives. And the reality of it can be quite overwhelming, and resistance to it can seem at times futile. Yet God did not create us for futility and hopelessness. Go with me over to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 16. It says, "Therefore we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal." Eternal. God created us, as we're told back, all the way back at the beginning of the Bible, in His own image. We are not simply the products of random, impersonal, physical forces. We are beings that God, by His grace, created in His image. And by His grace, we can put forth effort that will be effective in overcoming the degradation that is otherwise common to this physical existence. And ultimately, this is only accomplished in Christ alone, as we just sang, one of my favorite songs. So thanks, Steve, for leading that. Yet, for that to happen, it requires each of us to take responsibility. It takes our response to order our lives after Jesus Christ. Go to Galatians chapter 6 and verse 7. It says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. And let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith." We learn from our Creator, from the creator of the natural law of biogenesis, which is life produces life after its own kind, that this corresponds to a spiritual law. We reap what we sow. Many people are putting their gardens in this time of year, their vegetable gardens, flower gardens. If you want a particular crop, you need to sow the seed of that crop. You can't sow just any seed and wish for and hope for something else to be produced. The illustration I like to use is, I love to plant radish seeds. Most people don't care for radishes like I enjoy them. So I do enjoy the fruit. I enjoy radishes. But the main reason I like to do it is you put them in the ground and they're up within just a few days if circumstances are right, and you get a good radish in less than a month, whereas other seeds take longer. And so what I really like is to plant radish seeds and get corn, you know, and corn on the cob and get it. But corn takes a lot longer. But if I'm planting radish, I can't expect to get corn. You reap what you sow. I cannot sow to the flesh and expect to reap the things of the Spirit. That would be just as silly as me sowing radish seeds and expecting to get corn. It won't work. It doesn't happen. God has not designed it to be that way. And similarly, I cannot expect to create spiritual order out of disorder without great expense of energy and effort. It's going to take effort on our parts. You can't just sit back and let it happen naturally, because it's not natural. It's spiritual. It's going to take effort. So we're going to talk over the next two lessons about getting our houses in order. The obligation that each of us has to get my own house in order. And I've stated it that way to make it personal, because in this first lesson, we're going to talk about taking ownership of this effort, of making that this is something I can't push off onto somebody else. I have to take personal responsibility. There are all kinds of faulty inclinations that people have. Many are inclined to shirk responsibility. Blame shifting has occurred from the very beginning. Genesis chapter 3, you will recognize that text as when man and woman realized the consequence of their sin of eating the fruit that had been forbidden to them. And God confronts them about that. And Adam says, that woman you gave me, she gave to me and I ate. What is he doing there? He's shifting blame. He's shifting blame to the woman, and then he's shifting blame to God. That woman you gave me. He's not taking personal responsibility. And it's easy, again, for us to objectively look at that story and see that point, that he is blame shifting. What does Eve do as soon as he shifts the blame to her? The serpent deceived me. So Adam blamed Eve and God, and Eve blamed the serpent. The devil made me do it. That idea. And we're still very good at that. Indeed, the apple does not fall very far from the tree. Many of us assume that the bad things that happen in our lives are due to outside forces or failures. And it isn't that that can't happen. Of course it can. But a lot of times, the negatives that happen in our lives are a result of our failures. Just as I talked about the other night, when we talk about frustration, our children frustrate us, don't they? Why? We raised them. We're responsible for the way that they behave. And especially when they are young and formative, we're the trainers of them. If they're frustrating us, it's on us. But we like to shift the blame. It is true that others can have a bad influence on us and share in the blame. Of course, evil companionships have a tendency to corrupt us. And yes, Satan, like a roaring lion, is seeking to devour us. And it's true that others can neglect their duties and also share in the blame. Many children left to themselves without godly parental training become the next generation of criminals. And the failure of parents to train their children in God's ways is without doubt the leading cause of dysfunctional families, dysfunctional churches, and dysfunctional nations. Yet these realities do not excuse us from personal responsibility to seek God and His ways, nor do they justify our repeating these sins because our parents and our grandparents did them. So, thinking of these faulty inclinations, there is procrastination or laziness. I'm not saying all procrastination is laziness, but sometimes that is why we procrastinate, is because we are lazy. In Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 4, it says, "The sluggard will not plow because of winter. Therefore, he will beg during the harvest and have nothing." Okay? We put roadblocks. We put things that might happen. This might happen. And so we never act. And then we're surprised that when harvest time comes, as to use this illustration, or to use my sowing illustration of the garden, I never got around to planting that corn, those beans or whatever, and there's no beans to harvest come fall. Well, it's because we allowed other things to interfere with that sowing. Or go with me over to Proverbs chapter 26. Proverbs 26, beginning with verse 13. It says, "The slothful man says, 'There's a lion in the road. A fierce lion is in the streets.' As a door turns on its hinges, so does the slothful turn on his bed. The slothful man buries his hand in the bowl. It wearies him to bring it back to his mouth. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly." So here he's focusing in on the sluggard or the lazy man. When we do not want to do something, we can come up with all kinds of excuses that sound good to us in the moment. We think that's going to carry weight with whomever we're sharing that excuse with. Rarely does it. People can see through that because they do it too. We've all done it. We've all behaved this way. We know that there's something that needs to be done and we want it to be done, but we don't want to do it. And so continually, week after week, something comes up that doesn't allow us to pursue that. And the excuses, like I said, sound good to us. And we reject the answers that people offer of those who have been successful. There have been plenty of people, that experts that have been good with time management, that have been good with health, that have been good with exercise, that have been good with diet and all those sorts of things. And I'm not saying that those are anywhere close to being the most important things. There have been good people who have been good in athletics or successful in business. And, you know, you imagine yourself, well, I would be good in this business or this job, or I would be good playing this sport, or I would be good organizing this kind of thing. But we don't listen to those who have been good at those things. And then we scratch our heads and wonder, well, why am I not good at this? Why did I never accomplish this? It's because we were lazy. That was not a priority to us. And don't get me wrong, everything I just listed off doesn't need to be a priority in your life. We all have to prioritize how we use our time. We can't all be experts and great at everything. We're just not equipped to do that, and that's why we need one another. But let's not be surprised when we imagined such and such, but we never got around to doing what needed to be done in order to accomplish such and such. And sometimes laziness is the reason that we put that off. But there's another reason besides laziness, and that is fear. We don't get around to doing things sometimes because we're afraid. You just go over to the next book in the Bible, if you went with me to Proverbs, and you go to Ecclesiastes chapter 11 and verse 3. It says there, "If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it shall lie. He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. Clouds bring rain, and trees sometimes fall. We've been talking just beforehand about how stormy this spring seems to have been. And those winds come along, those tornadoes come along, and they knock a whole lot of things down. And fear of those things often keep us from doing what needs to be done. It might happen, and so we wait, we procrastinate. Because why bother doing something when something else is going to mess that up? And if we become fixated on worst-case scenarios, the possibilities of these things happen, we're going to end up with what people call analysis paralysis, and we'll fail to accomplish anything needful. Because bad things might happen that would either cause the work that I'm going to put into this to be a waste of time, or cause me to decide that something else needs to be done. And therefore, we end up doing nothing because we're afraid of what might happen. And admittedly, sometimes fears are masks themselves for laziness. Consider what was said to the one talent man who buried his talent. In Matthew chapter 25, you'll recall Jesus' parable that he spoke on this subject. Matthew 25 and verse 24 beginning. And we're not taking the time to read the entire parable. We're just jumping into the different talents that had been given to these different ones. He who had received the one talent came and said, "Lord, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. And I was afraid." There it is, fear. "I was afraid and went and hid your talent in the ground. Look, there you have what is yours." But his Lord answered and said to him, "You wicked and lazy servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed. Therefore, you ought to have deposited my money with the bankers, and at my coming I would have received back my own with interest. Therefore, take the talent from him and give it to him who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have abundance. But from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Fear kept the man who had been given graciously one talent to work with. He thought, there's risk involved in investment or whatever. And so I'd rather bury my talent so that at least I have that to give back. Are we sometimes that way, so cautious that we end up not producing any fruit? We're only able to give back what we were given in the first place. Sometimes we do that out of fear, or sometimes we do that out of laziness. So, these are inclinations that must be resisted. We need to own this as our responsibility. So let's talk about what ownership looks like, what taking responsibility looks like. And personal responsibility begins with being self-critical. Self-critical. We've been talking about the word discipline last night and on Friday night, and how that we oftentimes look at that negatively. Discipline is a negative thing. I hope that we have a better appreciation for the word discipline, that it is not always negative. It can be positive. And the same thing goes with criticism. Criticism we think of as always being negative. Well, a lot of times it is negative, but it isn't always negative. It is looking at something critically, and sometimes you can look at something critically and say, "Oh, this is good. This is good." Or you say, "This is bad, and this needs correction." And so this taking personal responsibility begins with being self-critical. So go over to Luke chapter 6 and verse 41. It says, "And why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not perceive the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, Brother, let me remove the speck that is in your eye when you yourself do not see the plank that is in your own eye. Hypocrite. First, remove the plank from your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck that is in your brother's eye. We've already made this observation in this series. It's easy to be critical of others, to complain about others, to be frustrated with others, to blame others. But those judgments, and that's what those are, those judgments need to first be applied to ourselves before they can be effectively made to others. And we oftentimes don't want to wait for that in our own lives. Unfortunately, the typical response to this observation, as I think I made this observation earlier, is to stop being critical. Because we're afraid, or we're lazy. That's the inclination still. We don't want to be critical of others because we don't want them to be critical of us. And that's not a healthy situation. The instruction of our Lord, if you notice here as he gives it, is to first remove the planks or the beams or whatever is in our eyes so that we can see clearly to remove that which is in other people's eyes. Yet too often we don't want criticism, so we do nothing. And we all just got this mutual agreement to leave one another alone. And we think that that's the course, the path to peace. And it isn't long term. Jesus says that we are personally responsible to remove or to submit to others doing so on our behalf, specks that are in our eyes. If you go on, keep reading there, verse 43. It says, for a good tree does not bear bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. For every tree is known by its own fruit. For men do not gather figs from thorns, nor do they gather grapes from a bramble bush. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good, and an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings forth evil. For out of the abundance of the heart his mouth speaks. So, this is just in harmony with what we already observed earlier from Galatians about we reap what we sow, the seed illustration. We're not going to bear good fruit if we're sowing bad seed in our lives. We need to look at the fruit of our lives critically to determine whether we are good or whether we are evil. And our introspection needs to be according to God's standards. God's standards. You go back to verse 40, just prior to this section we've been reading. A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who is perfectly trained will be like his teacher. We are not above Jesus Christ. And I think everyone here would acknowledge that we're not above Jesus Christ. But we need to seek to be like him because that's what a disciple does. And you see in the word disciple, the word discipline. Discipline has the word, I guess I should say, disciple in it. And so we are therefore subject to the correction of the master. The disciple is subject to the correction of the master. If we are not bearing this kind of fruit in our lives, we're not going to be becoming like our teacher. And we need one another to help with that. It begins with ourselves. We take that ownership on ourselves, our responsibility to be self-critical. And we need to do that. And that may seem like a daunting task, admittedly. But it is the nature of discipleship. Go to chapter 9. In Luke chapter 9 and verse 23, it says, then he said to them, Jesus said to them all, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. It requires denying self and each taking up his own cross. Nobody else gets to bear your cross. We each bear our own. Oftentimes, this is in the situation of persecution that we face. We may feel like we're having trials that we endure, burdens that we have. And this is not just acknowledging flaws, but the necessary crucifixion of the old self so that I can be raised to a life with Christ now living in me. That's basically what Paul said in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. The life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up for me. It is an acknowledgement of our own guilt to take up our cross. Well, so many times, oh, it's my cross to bear. Is it talking about some negative thing that's going on in our lives? But really, taking up our cross is an acknowledgement of our guilt. Jesus, yes, bore a cross, but it wasn't his guilt. It was ours that he was bearing. But we're told to come follow him. So we have to bear this daily and follow him. It requires me to follow Christ more than anybody else, more than any other person. Remember, whoever does not bear his cross and come after me, Jesus said in chapter 14, verse 27, cannot be my disciple. Therefore, it is our personal responsibility to examine ourselves whether we are in the faith, 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 5. We need to prove ourselves, test ourselves. The question is, will we do that? If we won't, there will be others who will be happy to step in and do it for us. Well, maybe not. Again, it depends on the environment in which you live, the family of which you are a part, the local church of which you are a part. But we need this self-examination. Point that I want to make that is hopeful here is that by God's grace, we can break the cycle of repeating the sins of our fathers, our forefathers. We can break the generational dysfunction that we see so often. That is possible in Jesus Christ. And we see a lot of it in the world. Again, it's easier for us to see it in the world because there are always people who are in worse situations than we, than ourselves. And so we look at the world, we say, oh, look at that. Oh, can you believe their child did this? That their family is like that? We can see the dysfunction clearly in other places. And then we see it repeated. Those children grow up and they do the same with their children. We just see that repeated over and over again. But by God's grace, that can be broken for anybody who will come to Jesus Christ. This is how I set my own house in order, is I take personal responsibility. For myself, first and foremost, and then all of those that I can influence for good. Certainly, it is the inclination of children to be like their parents. But because we are neither animals nor robots, we are capable of choosing to deny the fleshly course that perhaps our forefathers have taken and choose a higher calling. We are not excused from personal responsibility to make these kinds of choices because God has promised to provide and has provided a way of escape 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13 talks about that. That there's always this way of escape for every one of us. Sometimes we feel like temptation and testing trials come upon us in such amounts that we have no choice but to give in. But we are told by the Apostle Paul that God has provided a way of escape. We're just not taking it. Maybe because it looks harder than what we're going through. Maybe because we're lazy. Maybe because we're just generally procrastinating, hoping things just get better on their own, sort of like sowing radish seeds and hoping to get corn. But we are not taking that way of escape. We can probably, all of us, every one of us, can look back at our failures, the things that we wish we had done better, and can see, I didn't take that path. I took this path because it looked easier, or I was selfish, or whatever. But likewise, we are promised by God that if we will steadfastly resist Satan, he will flee from us, 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 9. So we got to resist. Resist him. He'll flee from us. And as we talked about last night, that if we'll not despise God's discipline, it will yield the peaceable fruit of righteousness. There you go. The sowing aspect, the illustration's there again. It's going to yield the peaceable fruit of righteousness, but you have to sow, you have to train, you have to discipline, you have to do the right thing. The fact is that getting my own house in order may very well require me as an individual to decide to renounce the way I was raised or to go against prevailing public opinion. Or otherwise repent in order to follow Jesus and to then create a culture of righteousness in my own home. And that will indeed take a determined effort. It requires us to take action rather than procrastinating. It begins, and this idea of taking action begins with counting the cost. You recognize that phrase. Luke chapter 14 and verse 28. Just after Jesus says in verse 27, "For whoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple." Verse 28, Jesus says, "For which of you intending to build a tower does not sit down first and count the cost, whether he has enough to finish it, lest after he has laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.'" Then he gives another illustration. Verse 31, "Or what king going to make war against another king does not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? Or else, while the other is still a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks conditions of peace. So likewise, whoever of you does not forsake all that he has cannot be my disciple." He says it again. It's never wise to be ignorant of the cost of something. Even if it's something that must be done, it's wise to know the cost that is going to be required in order to do it. It helps us, if nothing else, to appreciate the value of what we are doing and to keep that perspective throughout the doing of it. It motivates us. Counting the cost motivates us to press on to finish the job that was started. And it helps us to prioritize because we can't put everything in order all at the same time. Just impossible task for us finite beings. And so we have to prioritize. For example, I can't put your life in order for you. I can't fix the world's problems. I can share the good news with you. I can share this lesson with you. I can direct you to the one who can fix your problems. You see, you can lead a sinner to the fountain of life, but you can't make him drink of that fountain. And here's the bottom line. Jesus, in talking to people about what it takes to be a disciple of his, following Jesus costs everything. It costs everything. And you need to know that going into it. I've heard the phrase, more times than I cared to count, people talking about, in fact, I just heard it last week. Somebody made this comment to me, that there are certain individuals who have not yet become Christians who would hardly have to change anything in order to be Christians. And they wonder why they haven't yet become Christians. And I don't know the reasons, that are the impediments to specific individuals and what keeps them from obeying the gospel. And I kind of understand what people mean by that. They'd hardly have to change anything. But that's not true. Being a disciple of Jesus requires us to change everything. And it costs us everything, literally. Because everything that I am and everything that I own and everything that I influence is to be used for His glory, to be used in His kingdom. And if we don't have that, Jesus says, if we don't have that attitude, Jesus says, you can't be my disciple. So therefore, we need to put all of our resources into this effort, to see that it is completed, that it is finished. And we need to see that a failure to surrender all ultimately means that we will not complete the job. I was using this, I used this text many years ago in Africa when I was studying with a man there. And he came to the conclusion he needed to be baptized into Christ. And he wanted to know, he said to me, how much will it cost? This very poor, poor country. And he wanted to know how much it was going to cost him to be baptized. Money. He thought he was going to have to pay for this. And I said, it will cost you everything. Because I read this text to him. It's going to cost you everything. And of course, we paid for it. It did cost, actually, money. We had to go rent a pool somewhere because there was no baptistry. We rented a pool and baptized him. We paid that cost. But the point is, there are costs, hidden costs sometimes we'll talk about. But Jesus is very upfront. And taking this action that we need to get our houses in order requires us to see the cost that is involved. Usually, we need to act sooner rather than later. This gets back to the procrastination aspect. If you go back to Proverbs chapter 13. In Proverbs chapter 13 and verse 4, it says, the soul of a sluggard desires and has nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made rich. Many people neglect to look to the future, assuming that it will be as good or better than it is now. However, the diligent are like the ant that lays up supplies for the future, Proverbs chapter 6. It is what Joseph counseled Pharaoh to do in times of plenty in preparation for lean times that would come later. Getting something in order is most easily and effectively done the sooner we begin and before we're in the midst of a crisis. The longer disorder is a rule, the harder it will be to achieve, to put things in order. And we see that in all areas of our lives, from our closets to our garages, from our lawns to our gardens. We know this is true. From our desktops to our filing or our piling systems, we know disorder. The limitations of time places urgency on the need to act. When April 15th rolls around, is it a crisis or are you prepared? And so there's so many illustrations of this in our life. As we get older and our ability to work diminishes, are we prepared for those lean times or are we constantly fretting and worried? And what about as death draws nigh? The admonition of Ecclesiastes in chapter 12 and verse 1 is, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth before the difficult days come and the years draw near when you say, I have no pleasure in them. That's wise advice. So we need to act sooner rather than later. Don't kick the can down the road. Don't procrastinate on this. And I know this lesson can have a lot of guilt feeling coming because we all, every one of us here, regardless of how successful we may look in jobs, in spiritual pursuits, in our families or whatever, we have regrets. We have things that we wish we had done differently and done better. We've got to press on. We can't live in the past. We got to move on. And we have a God given responsibility toward our own house. Our own house, our own offspring. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8 basically tells us there that if we don't provide for our own, we're worse than an unbeliever. Failure to provide for our own is essentially to deny the faith. And that this is speaking to material needs, I think, is evident from the context, verse 4. But that isn't all that it's talking about. It's clear that this material provision is undergirded by spiritual values. And we have to provide that first and foremost. You might recall in Deuteronomy chapter 6, when before Moses leaves the children of Israel, and they're about to enter into the promised land, Moses talks about the fact that these commandments which I'm giving you are to be in your heart. Okay? It wasn't just to stay on the tablets of stone. It was to be in their hearts, and they were to talk about them with their children when they got up in the morning and when they were walking along on the way. In other words, this was to infuse every aspect of their daily life. That we're always relating things somehow to God and His will, and it has that impact in our lives. And so that is the context that God intended for spiritual values to be taught. And we cannot rightly shift that responsibility to schools. We can't shift that responsibility even to local churches and the Bible class program. We can't shift that to any other entity. It is our responsibility. And that's repeated in the New Testament in Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, where Paul puts the responsibility squarely on the shoulders of fathers to bring their children up in the training and admonition of the Lord. He said, don't provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. Too many, for fear of the clouds or the wind or the rain or the alleged lion in the street, have failed to discipline their children. Because, oh, it might drive them away. It might do this. We think of worst case scenarios, and therefore we're afraid to do what God tells us to do. Rather, it is the failure of discipline in the Lord that ultimately provokes children to wrath. When they aren't trained, when they aren't given boundaries, when they aren't taught what they need to be taught. That gets them mad at their parents for being failures as parents spiritually. That gets them mad at the world. We need to act now. Proverbs chapter 27 and verse 23. It says, Be diligent to know the state of your flocks and to tend to your herds. For riches are not forever, nor does a crown endure to all generations. When the hay is removed and the tender grass shows itself and the herbs of the mountains are gathered in, the lambs will provide your clothing and the goats the price of a field. You shall have enough goat's milk for your food, for the food of your household and the nourishment of your maidservants. I know that sounds very agrarian in its approach to things, but it's a great illustration. Diligence is needed now because material things are fleeting. Do you know the status of your flocks? You might say, I don't have any sheep. Do you know your income and your outgo? That's basically what he's talking about here. Do you have a plan to manage what God has graciously given to you, entrusted to you as a steward? Are you preparing for the future? Again, there are spiritual values behind these principles and greater applications to be made to things way more important than material things that are used here in this text. Go to Proverbs chapter 19. In Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 18. Chasten your son or discipline your son while there is hope, and do not set your heart on his destruction. In other words, if you don't discipline him in a timely way, you're essentially, effectively setting his heart on destruction. Do you want that for your children? We have a very limited time in which to get our houses in order spiritually. And we need discipline while there is time. Otherwise, we set our children up for failure. Or as he says in chapter 13 and verse 24, that we do this promptly, that we do this early, some translations will say. So let us remember Joshua's words. As for me and my house, you see the ownership there? Taking ownership, taking personal responsibility. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Make that your determination. No matter your age, by the way. Your children may be all gone from the nest, but they're probably still alive, many of them. And you may have grandchildren or great-grandchildren. It doesn't stop. We have the opportunity to set our houses in order, and we need to get going on that, not tomorrow, but today. Thank you.